I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. Coming up on the show today, what it took for Loretta Lynch to be confirmed as the Attorney General of the United States, and why Democrats are fighting with President Obama over a free trade deal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But first, what's up with Philadelphia Eagles coach Chip Kelly? He's been making some controversial offseason decisions, including signing quarterbacks Tim Tebow and Sam Bradford and letting Shady McCoy and Jerry Macklin go. The NFL draft is next week. Joining us, as he often does when we talk about the Eagles and football, is Mike Sielski. He's sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Mike, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Always a pleasure, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Do you understand what Chip Kelly is doing?
I think he does, and I think it's kind of hard to see in the sense that he's looking for things in players that are really, really intangible. He's trying to, in his phrase, kind of build a culture where you get certain kind of guys who are willing to be coached and coached in the way that Chip wants to coach them. And so he's willing to take chances on guys who might have a rather checkered injury history, a player like Sam Bradford, who you mentioned, who's torn the anterior cruciate ligament in his left knee twice in the last 14 months or so. So, it's kind of hard to see at this point, but we've got a long way to go.
I mean, clearly there are risks involved in this, and it looks like he got rid of some of his stars, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, and that's been one of the topics that people who follow the NFL and the Eagles in particular have been discussing all offseason, which is LeSean Shady McCoy said at one point in an interview with the Philadelphia Inquirer that Chip doesn't like stars. And I think what McCoy was getting at is that Chip believes that his system of play and his culture of physical fitness and mental preparation and all that sort of stuff will ultimately help his team beat an opponent that has maybe more talented players, and that he doesn't want a guy who thinks of himself as a star. And certainly LeSean McCoy did, certainly DeSean Jackson, who left the team last year, I guess, in the spring of 2014 did. So Chip wants guys who are a little humbler, I guess, and he feels that guys like DeMarco Murray, the former running back for the Cowboys, and some other players they've acquired in this offseason fit that bill more than McCoy or Jackson did.
Does Tim Tebow fit that?
Tim Tebow certainly fits that from a culture and character standpoint. Nobody argues that, about him being a good person and a hard worker and the kind of guy that any football coach would want on his football team, provided you can figure out how to use him in the proper way. Tim hasn't actually played in an NFL game since 2002 when he was with the Jets, and he showed back then and probably even before that for all kind of the ballyhoo and attention that he gets, he's not what you'd call an every down quarterback in the NFL. He's just, his skill set doesn't allow for that. So the question becomes, if he actually makes the Eagles roster this year, how is Chip going to use him? And it's probably going to be in a limited role. He might be the third string quarterback, but the thinking is that Kelly will find a way to use him on special teams or in kind of a trick play sort of role. Almost like a Swiss Army knife. He can do a lot of different things. But again, it's an open question whether he's even going to be on the roster once the season begins.
What is Chip Kelly then? I mean, what does he want from his quarterbacks as you look at some of these choices he's been making, but also look back over what he's been doing in Philadelphia?
Well, I think he's like a lot of coaches in that he understands that if you have a great quarterback, you're well ahead of the game compared to an opponent that doesn't. You look at the New England Patriots with Tom Brady. You look at the Green Bay Packers with Aaron Rodgers. Those teams have tremendous quarterbacks, and it allows them to overcome some other weaknesses that the roster has. I think Chip knows he doesn't have a franchise quarterback yet, so he's trying to upgrade the position, and he's willing to take a chance to do that. I think he likes Sam Bradford's skill set, the accuracy with which he throws the ball, his arm strength, his decision-making, more than he liked Nick Foles' skill set, the quarterback that he traded to get Bradford. The question with Bradford is, can he stay healthy enough to stay on the field? And, of course, that gets us into the whole question which has been bandied about all offseason, as to whether the Eagles are going to try to make a play in the draft next week to get Marcus Mariota, who won the Heisman Trophy this year, who Chip recruited to Oregon and coached there. Chip loves him. Mariota loves Chip. It would seem a perfect fit. So, yeah, there's going to be a lot of intrigue next week once the draft begins.
And what do you think Chip Kelly is going to have to do to try to get that player that he wants so much?
Well, it would take a series of trades and moves. The Eagles, their first pick in the draft isn't until the 20th overall selection. And so it would seem that Mariota is projected to go among the top five or six picks. So in order for them to jump up to get Mariota, to get to the point where they could draft him or to entice a team that did draft him to give him up, they would have to give up an awful lot of draft picks and players, and nobody seems to think that they have that at this point. Now, Ed Manowitz, the team's player personnel director, basically said yesterday that the Eagles want to have as many draft picks as possible because the draft is a crapshoot, and the more chances you have to get basically the more metal rods you hold out in the lightning storm, the more the likelier it is that you're going to get hit by lightning, which is what the draft really is. So Manowitz kind of poo-pooed the idea that they would trade all these draft picks just to get this one player. And in a vacuum, he's right. But the thing that has everybody skeptical of that is that Kelly has a particularly close relationship with Mariota. He knows that very well. Mariota is regarded as the perfect quarterback to run Chip Kelly's offensive system. So everybody's kind of going, if there's any way that Chip can get this kid, it's likely that he's going to try to do that.
Well, I would assume that other teams are going to try to block that move on Kelly's part.
You got that right. That's the thing about Philadelphia sports, Marty. As you know, we kind of have blinders on to whatever anybody else outside of Philadelphia is thinking. And there are plenty of other teams that are interested in Marcus Mariota that not only will have a chance to draft him before the Eagles do, but might be willing to make a big move to get him too. So the likelihood that the Eagles are going to come away from the draft with Mariota is very, very slim. And so I think Kelly understands that, and I think that's part of the reason he's kind of made the changes he has made in this offseason. You see, the Eagles now have three top-notch running backs, assuming they all stay healthy, in DeMarco Murray, Ryan Matthews, and Darren Sproles. You have several quarterbacks now on the roster, Sam Bradford, Mark Sanchez, Tim Tebow, G.J. Kinney, Matt Barkley. I think his philosophy is, okay, I may not have a franchise quarterback who I can center the entire team around, so I'm going to try to find another way to put points on the board. Maybe it's through a dynamic running game. Maybe it's doing something unconventional outside the box, which he's shown over his first 2 years in the NFL he's willing to do.
We are talking Eagles with Mike Sielski, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, specifically talking about some of the decisions that Philadelphia Eagles coach Chip Kelly has been making. And if you want to join our conversation, it's a three-parter in this hour of Radio Times. We'll be talking with Mike for about five or six more minutes. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Mike, one of the things that you wrote in one of your articles about what Chip Kelly has been doing is that he wants to stick it to the Cowboys in making some of these moves. Can you explain that to us?
Well, I didn't mean to suggest that he wanted to stick it to the Cowboys. I think I wrote that in after the Eagles had gone ahead and signed DeMarco Murray, who was the top running back in the NFL last year playing for the Dallas Cowboys. And it was, in the moment, it was a delicious thing for Eagles fans to know that even after the team had just traded away LeSean McCoy, who was arguably the best running back in Eagles history, Chip was able to adjust and sign DeMarco Murray and kind of steal the centerpiece of the Cowboys offense. And that's something that is not lost on – I don't think it's lost on Chip, and it's certainly not lost on Eagles fans and Eagles followers, because over a 16-game NFL season, you play six of your games against the teams in your own division. You play, if you're the Eagles, you play the Cowboys twice, the New York Giants twice, and the Washington Redskins twice. So you have to be really good against those teams that you're most familiar with. And so the Eagles have hurt the Cowboys in that regard. They've taken away a key part of their offense by signing Murray. So for Eagles fans, it was kind of like a thumb in the eye to the Cowboys. Like, hey, you know, you think that you got the better of us last year when your team made the playoffs. Well, ha, 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 Chip Kelly just stole away your best running back.
Let me put something else on the table here. And earlier this week, a federal judge in Philadelphia approved a class action settlement. In fact, this was on Wednesday, $765 million settlement involving concussions and the NFL. What's your take on that, Mike?
It's an interesting and ongoing story. And the crux of it and kind of the complication for the players who are trying to get compensated for their injuries and their suffering in the wake of their playing careers is that you have this push-pull between getting help for these guys now versus getting a bigger settlement down the road. So you can see both sides of it in the sense that you have players applauding, you have ex-players applauding the settlement saying, okay, we're going to get the help we need soon. And you have some other players or people fighting on behalf of other players who are saying, yeah, but is it going to be enough? Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting parts, I don't know if you've noticed this or happened to come across this within the last day or so, the family of Dave Duerson, a former NFL safety who committed suicide, and his suicide was linked to his suffering from CTE, which is a disease associated with head trauma, which has kind of become, if you want to call it that, the signature disease of the NFL. They are contesting the settlement of the suit because there were no future awards for players suffering from CTE were excluded from the settlement.
Oh, interesting.
And so, yeah, that's going to be really something to keep an eye on here because CTE has become kind of the three-letter word in a way associated with the NFL and concussions. And so if understanding of that disease and its incident rate continues to grow, you know, we're going to come to look at this settlement in a much different way in the years and months ahead.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye here, another, I think, criticism or even controversial part of the settlement, apparently the executives don't have to admit that they allegedly withheld information about concussions.
Yeah, that's true. And the NFL obviously doesn't want to do that because then it opens itself up to even more litigation. It's a complex issue because it gets into really the question of free will and what did players know? What do executives know? Trust me, you enter an NFL locker room and you ask the 50 to 70 guys who are in there, you will find guys who say, yeah, I'm aware of all the possibilities of the damage that could be done to me and to my brain in the years ahead, and I will still take that chance. Mm-hmm. And as long as you have that free will factor in there, this issue is going to remain very, very complex and just fascinating to follow and in some ways tragic to follow in the years ahead.
Well, Mike, always a pleasure talking with you. I'm sure we'll be talking with you once the season gets underway. Mike Sielski, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, thanks for joining us in this portion of Radio Times today.
Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. And we have waiting in the wings, Jonathan Wiseman. We are shifting gears three times during this hour. We'll be talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the controversy it's kicked up in this country. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade agreement between the United States, Canada, and 10 Asian Pacific countries, has been under negotiation for about 5 years now. And it has made for some strange bedfellows with President Obama and Republicans on one side and Democrats, unions, and environmentalists lining up on the other. Obama called out his critics earlier this week, including Senator Elizabeth Warren. Here's an edited clip.
I love Elizabeth. We're allies on a whole host of issues, but she's wrong on this. And when you hear folks make a lot of suggestions about how bad this trade deal is, when you dig into the facts, they are wrong.
Elizabeth Warren fought back, accusing the president of hiding information about the agreement from the public. So what is going on and what is in this free trade deal, the biggest and most important since NAFTA? Jonathan Wiseman is economic policy reporter for The New York Times and joins us on Radio Times to explain what is going on here. Jonathan Wiseman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here, Marty.
So what is in this deal? Do you know? I know that you had access to some WikiLeaks, but does anyone know what's actually in this deal?
You know, I mean, one of the biggest complaints about the Trans-Pacific Partnership is that very few people really know what it is. The documents, the negotiating documents, are kept in these bizarre, locked, secret rooms for members of Congress to go and peruse, but they cannot take notes. They cannot bring them out. They can bring an aide, a properly cleared aide, in with them to look over them, but they cannot say, hey, I'm going to send my trusted trade aide to go in, take notes, and come up with a memo for me, because that aide needs to have a member of Congress with them at all time. There has to be somebody from the U.S. Trade Representative's office in there with them. It's almost bizarrely secretive. But what we know is that this is a 12-nation trade accord with countries around the Pacific Rim that represent 40% of the world's GDP. It is a huge trade deal.
It is clearly a huge trade deal, but why the secrecy? I mean, that sounds like the kind of secrecy used for national security issues.
Right. I mean, look, we got one of the chapters on the so-called investor-state dispute settlement. That is a chapter just devoted to how an investor can take a country in this accord to these tribunals if policy changes somehow disrupt their investment in their particular country. This chapter, the cover of it said this is not to be declassified for 4 years after the TPP goes in force.
Wow.
Or if the TPP collapses, 4 years after that collapse. I mean, what the proponents would say is you cannot negotiate in public. You need to keep these things in secret until the negotiating is done, because you'll just disrupt the negotiations. But because it has been so secretive, the paranoia about this accord is just stratospheric, through the roof. Because people make whatever they can say whatever they want, the administration can only kind of vaguely say that's not true.
Well, you wrote about this. You got some of this information from WikiLeaks. And I'll just quote you here, Jonathan Wiseman: an ambitious 12-nation trade accord pushed by President Obama would allow foreign corporations to sue the United States government for actions that undermine their investment, quote-unquote, expectations, and hurt their business, according to a classified document. Now, is that unusual in trade deals?
They're called investor-state dispute settlement chapters in other ones, in other trade accords, many other trade accords. What's different about this one is just, first of all, they have not been used very much, but in recent years, literally the last 2 years, companies and their lawyers have really discovered that this can be a useful tool. And with the chapter with TPP, people really fear that these kinds of disputes will skyrocket because of the states that are involved. Mm. Japan. I mean, it was one thing to have an investor state dispute with Mexico or with Canada, these countries that we get along with, that we have fairly open markets with. But when you get into accords with places like Japan, you're dealing with companies like Toyota with huge, you know, legal staffs, huge resources at their disposal, and a new tool for them to use to really go after any member of the Trans-Pacific Partnership to object to policies that might impact the investments that they are making in that country, the United States being one of them.
Let me quote something else that President Obama said, and essentially he's kind of saying, trust me to negotiate for the good of American workers and for the good of the country. But he says, when you hear folks make a lot of suggestions about how bad this trade deal is, when you dig into the facts, they're wrong. I would not be putting this forward if I was not absolutely certain that this was going to be good for American workers. Based on what you know, Jonathan, can we believe what the president is saying?
I mean, I could not say one way or the other, and I really can't. I can say this, that President Obama is basically using the goodwill that he has with labor and liberal America to say, look, I'm not going to, I am Barack Obama. I'm not going to do anything to hurt you. I'm on your side, you know, and he hopes that that's enough because there's so much secrecy around this that he can't exactly just point to the text and say, this is why you should trust me. You just have to trust me.
But, I mean, clearly, Senator Elizabeth Warren, she's not buying it.
Well, it's not just Elizabeth Warren. Frankly, Elizabeth Warren may be the big mouthpiece on this, and she's the one that goes on to Rachel Maddow on MSNBC and spouts off. But she's not on the front line. The front line is like Sherrod Brown, senator from Ohio, who's actually on the Senate Finance Committee. Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders the other day tried to bring the formal drafting of Trade Promotion Authority to a halt single-handedly. There is this basically the vast majority of Democrats are opposing this. And remember, there's two stages, and we should talk about both stages.
Sure.
There's first fast track, getting President fast track authority. That's what Congress is right now dealing with. Then there's the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which still is being negotiated. We haven't even seen that yet.
And what the president wants, fast-track authority. Congress obviously wants to, slow things down and have some input into what he's negotiating?
Well, fast-track authority, which is something that every president except Richard Nixon has had in modern times, fast-track authority is Congress would maintain the right to vote yes or no on any trade deal that the president produces, including the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but would forfeit its right to actually amend the trade deal. Now, this is important for presidents because negotiating partners like Japan, they also have domestic politics involved, and they don't want to sign off on a trade accord and then say, okay, all right, we can live with this, and then have the U.S. Congress change it and then have to go back to their people and say, okay, now you have to do this all over again and approve this new version that the U.S. Congress did. So the first step that Obama needs is to get fast-track authority so he can go back to the negotiations over the Trans-Pacific Partnership and say, look, whatever we get done, Congress is not going to meddle with. That's right now Congress's big decision, and in this bizarro world that we live in, Republicans really are lining up to give this president that they have hated for so long. The Republicans are lining up to give him fast track authority, and the Democrats are by and large lining up against him.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Jonathan Wiseman. He's economic policy reporter for the New York Times. We are talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and these are negotiations that have been ongoing involving 12 countries. I will name the countries here: Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, the United States, and Vietnam. And it is a trade deal that has all of a sudden created quite a controversy, and that's what we're talking about in this hour of, or in this portion of Radio Times, I should say, and again with Jonathan Wiseman. To join our conversation, any questions or comments, and this is a very important deal that is being negotiated, as big and as important as NAFTA, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jonathan, we have a tweet from Walt. He says this is not a trade deal. This is companies moving goods inside their supply chain across borders is not trade. Is he right? Is he wrong? What do you think about that?
I don't know why you would say that's not trade. I mean, if, let's say, Toyota is using the new rules of the road set up by the Trans-Pacific Partnership to get to ease the flow of parts and supplies from Vietnam or the United States or Canada to Japan for the final assembly of a Camry, that seems to be trade. I think that we're splitting hairs here.
Do you think that some of the pushback against this TPP, as it's called, comes from the controversy that surrounded NAFTA, almost like 25 years ago?
Absolutely. Everything goes back to NAFTA. Okay. NAFTA was kind of the template for both sides to wage this war. You know, President Obama in 2008, when he was campaigning for the presidency, pledged that he was going to renegotiate NAFTA. He actually campaigned as a trade skeptic. Now the administration is saying this is the president making good on that the United States, Mexico, and Canada are all party to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The president says, look, I'm doing what I said. I'm renegotiating NAFTA along with nine other countries, and we're going to put in new environmental standards, new labor standards, now human rights standards that were not part of NAFTA. NAFTA always comes up. And, of course, opponents point to NAFTA and say, you know, you promised that NAFTA was going to reinvigorate U.S. manufacturing, it was going to be this great big job creator, and it wasn't, and why should we expand that at this point? NAFTA is kind of the Rosetta Stone of the trade debate.
I mean, can we say, it sounds like we can say to some degree that NAFTA benefited some segments of the economy, other segments of the economy not so much?
Absolutely. You know, it's very hard to quantify the impact of these trade accords, because certainly I think even opponents and supporters would say that the trade agreement with, let's say, with South Korea, with Mexico and Canada, they have had their benefits. They've benefited especially the service sectors, the U.S. insurance market, Hollywood, things, you know, areas that have really flourished in the global economy. But then they've really probably hurt other sectors, especially low-wage sectors like textiles, which basically have just virtually vanished with the advent of these global trade accords.
Well, I'm thinking about textiles and what textile workers get paid in this part of the world that we're talking about. It's even less than what they would have gotten paid in Mexico, or are getting paid in Mexico.
That's right. I mean, you're competing now with Vietnam. Vietnam's presence in these TPP negotiations is very significant because, obviously, it's got very low-wage workers. It also is a communist country with state-owned enterprises, and this is a whole new wrinkle that we really have never dealt with in trade negotiations. How do you negotiate with a country that that is a command economy? And there is a chapter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership just to deal with state-owned enterprises. But I've read it. Nobody else, very few people have.
Which is part of, I guess, the problem in trying to talk about this and to understand it. One of the things you've been writing, Jonathan, is that just because the way things go, this could spill over into the next president, what actually might be the person who would either sign on or sign off to this trade deal.
That's right. George H.W. Bush actually negotiated NAFTA, but then it fell to Bill Clinton to actually pass it. And I really would not be surprised at all if the Trans-Pacific Partnership is the same way, because the Trade Promotion Authority, the fast-track bill that is now making its way through Congress, actually has this very long delay. When the negotiations are completed on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the president must wait 3 months before he actually signs it. And for two of those 3 months, the entire text of the Trans-Pacific Partnership has to be finally made public. So it's going to sit out there for 2 months. Then there is another 1 month delay before Congress can take it up. So for at least 4 months, and probably longer, after the negotiations finally conclude, this thing is going to just sit out there in public taking shots. And then by the time it does get to Congress, it will be really in the middle of the presidential season. The White House really wanted to avoid this. They really wanted the TPP done before the hoopla of the 2006 presidential campaign, and to get Democrats on board fast track. They had to agree to this to the terms of this delay, this public delay. And I think that that really could mean that TPP does not even come to a vote in this Congress under this president.
We're almost out of time here, but if it is passed, does the TPP give the U.S. a greater presence in the sort of Asian Pacific area and a bigger chance to take on China?
Absolutely. In fact, when the president and when the White House makes its case in private up on Capitol Hill, a lot of this is about geopolitics. The idea is, look, we need to bring these trading partners into our orbit now as a counterweight to China's economic power in Asia. It is a lot of this is about the United States, you know, Obama's pivot to China, to Asia, and the United States' ability to influence an area that is more and more coming under the thrall of the Chinese giant.
You had a headline concern that the U.S. was retreating from economic leadership. Is this also part of that as well?
Well, especially if it collapses. If the Trans-Pacific Partnership collapses, a lot of our trading partners, people, especially like countries like Singapore and Malaysia, will really feel like the U.S. pivot to Asia is a failure, and the United States just simply is not able to throw its weight, either its political weight or its economic weight, around the way it once did. And that's just at a time when China really is ramping up. So, yes, I think that this the fate of the TPP is very much entwined with the United States' ability to influence the world economy.
Jonathan Weissman, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times today.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Economic policy reporter for The New York Times. And waiting in the wings, we'll be talking about the confirmation yesterday of Loretta Lynch for U.S. Attorney General. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscow-Aim. On Thursday, yesterday, Loretta Lynch was confirmed as U.S. Attorney General, with 10 Republicans, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, voting with all the Democrats. She will be sworn in next week, making her the first African-American woman to hold this important post. Lynch waited for more than 5 months for this vote. Her nomination got caught up in a fight over an abortion provision in a human trafficking bill. Republicans also objected to her support of President Obama's executive actions on immigration. Here to walk us through the twists and turns of this nomination process and to tell us more about this new attorney general is Del Quinton Wilbur, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, who covers the Justice Department and Homeland Security. Del Quinton Wilbur, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, it's great to be here. I don't mean to correct you, but it's Bloomberg News, not The Wall Street Journal.
Oh, my gosh. You're absolutely right. Thank you for that. It was a busy morning pulling all this stuff together. Not an acceptable excuse.
People would shoot me if I pretended to be a Wall Street Journal reporter.
I'm glad you did. No, thank you for taking care of that. Putting that aside, was this delay about Loretta Lynch? Was it about President Obama? Was it about the Senate or a combination of all three?
Oh, you mean her delay?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's a complicated tale of inside Washington politics, you know, kind of deep-rooted dislike of Obama's policies by Republicans. You know, others, Politico had an interesting story today about Lorenzo Lynch's father. You know, he came and he kind of views it more through the civil rights prism, like perhaps some people aren't ready for a black female attorney general.
Wow.
And so, you know, it's, you know, there are all kinds of things mixed up in it. You know, they were particularly irked, the Republicans, that she backed Obama's immigration policies and his kind of, you know, his effort to, you know, fix the, or what he would say was fixing the immigration system through executive action without congressional input, you know, for 5 million undocumented immigrants. And they really don't like that. They think it's illegal. And, in fact, one of them asked him, I find it fascinating, said, hey, if you were Elliot Richardson, would you have fired Archibald Cox for Richard Nixon, or would you have resigned?
Ah, interesting.
And she had an interesting answer. She was like, oh, you know, history already decided that, da 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 da. So they were very upset about that. So that's why they voted against her, they said.
Well, it's interesting because on the one hand, presidents generally get to pick the attorney general that they want. But on the other hand, as you say, some members of the Senate said that what a president wants is illegal. And then if she carries this out, she's essentially breaking the law.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. You know, and also I feel like, you know, other attorney generals, like being attorney general, you kind of can get caught up in the politics of everything. So I think Ashcroft even, you know, had a similar vote margin, like 58-42 maybe. And so, and that was right after September, that was well before September 11th, and he was a former senator. So I think they often get caught up in that. And this is one of those things too, where like, there are all kinds of broad issues swirling around this that are much bigger than Loretta Lynch herself. And I think that they also did themselves a disservice, the White House, by letting Eric Holder stay on for so long. Like, Holder's like, I'm going to quit when she's sworn in. And I don't. If he had said, I'm stepping down now, we're going to have Jim Cole, who is the deputy attorney general, the acting attorney general, the White House could have used an argument against the Republicans saying, you guys are all pro-national security, yet you're not moving to confirm my head of one of the most important pieces of national security in the country. And we have this acting person for like 2 months, 3 months. And I think that argument may have helped them.
What's so curious is it was clear that the Republican members of Congress do not like Eric Holder. But as you say, you know, he I think announced that he wanted to step down back in September. And he was with them until, I guess, till next week.
He won't go away. And like maybe they like that. Maybe it's an easy punching bag for them. You know, hey, we can keep punching Eric Holder. I don't know. Like Holder was walking around with his staff was walking about, you know, those armbands you get for, you know, like Live Strong, or they all mean something, little
Yes.
armbands. Like someone up in his office suite created one saying, free Eric Holder. And they all were walking around with him. And so, like, you know, I think he kind of also acknowledges that, hey, tactically it would have been better. But, you know, he also loves the job, I think, and got to stick around for six more months. And, you know, what I find kind of interesting for Loretta Lynch, I wrote a story for today's Bloomberg about how, like, you know, like, Attorney General faces a lot of challenges, from, like, combating terrorism, right, to civil rights enforcement, voting rights stuff, big decisions on what to appeal, what not to appeal, what laws to uphold. And then she has a Republican Congress that had a toxic relationship with her predecessor. But I think her biggest challenge will be, like, the tick, tick, ticking of the clock. You know, she has just 21 months, right?
Right.
And before Obama steps down. So what can she really get done? And I think that it's interesting. I'm not great at prognosticating, and I'm often wrong, but it's interesting to see how, how she tried to subtly put her imprint on the Justice Department, because she's not going to have 6 years like Holder did, you know, to say, I'm going to do sentencing reform. I'm going to do this, because anything she starts will be over by the time that her successor is sworn in on, after January 20th, 2017.
Well, let me correctly reintroduce you. That's Del Quinton Wilbur, reporter for Bloomberg News, has been covering the Justice Department and Homeland Security. Actually wrote a book called Rawhide Down. And we've been talking about the fact that after about 5 months, Loretta Lynch was confirmed yesterday as a U.S. Attorney General. She will be sworn in next week, and pretty historic swearing in, because she will be the first African-American woman to hold this post. And we want to hear from you what you make of this nominee or this nomination. Also, what you make of the process that it took to get to this point. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Are you, Del, are you surprised that Mitch McConnell voted for her in the final analysis?
You know, I wish I was better at the politics of Capitol Hill. I'm kind of not surprised, because I think he wants to, you know, he was able to kind of show his mettle by, you know, fighting to get a concession on the sex trafficking bill that they passed, you know, like there's a whole fight of abortion language in it. And he won that. And I think then, you know, he had nothing left to like kind of nitpick or whatever. And I think that he was left, you know, I don't see any reason for him not to have voted for her. I think maybe it sets a bad precedent in the future if the Senate Majority Leader votes against a president's nominee who is, you know, by all measures qualified for the job. I mean, very few Republicans said she wasn't qualified for the job. Their argument was, she's not going to be independent enough. She's for these very controversial policies. We want someone different. But I don't think anyone said she wasn't. Very few. Mm. I think one or two may have argued that she hasn't had big manager experience, but beyond that, not many.
Well, tell us a little bit about Loretta Lynch. You've been writing about her, a bit about her background, also about her time in New York. What's a little bit about her life story?
Well, you know, she's a pastor's daughter. She grew up in North Carolina, achieved more than many people thought anyone could achieve. She went to Harvard Law School, became a corporate lawyer, you know, passed out one Friday at her desk, couldn't do that anymore, became a federal prosecutor. Did that for a while, became U.S. attorney under the first, under Clinton, at the end of the Clinton term, was confirmed to be U.S. attorney, then went into private practice again, but never kind of left the public service in her head. She did a lot of training, I think, for prosecutors and stuff across the country, and even spent a summer prosecuting war criminals in Rwanda.
Yeah.
You know, she went and investigated a case where a really kind of complicated perjury case. The International War Tribunal in Rwanda was very concerned that a bunch of bad actors were convincing witnesses to change their story after they testified, and they went after a witness for lying, changing the story. And her job was to prosecute that guy, you know, to uphold the justice system. She did that, spent a summer there. I wrote a story about it. You can find it on Bloomberg.
Yeah, in fact, I'm holding it in my hand here. It's really quite an extraordinary story in many ways, but it also seems like that was such an important summer and experience for her.
Yeah, I think if you did the same thing and it wasn't a formative experience for you, then I think that you're a cold-hearted, how could that not affect you? But as someone who has a predilection for justice and the American way and the justice system, I think that it probably even had a greater impact than it would for just an ordinary person. So she does that. Obama taps her to be U.S. attorney in Brooklyn, and she does that for 4 years. Or more, I guess. I think she's been there for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And now she's U.S. She was also very tight with Holder in that. In a story I wrote today, I'm like, you know, she's basically going to be Holder 2.0. Not in the sense that she's going to probably be as antagonistic as Holder was with the Republicans, but that she, has many of the same policies, ideas. Like, she'll fiddle around the edges of them. And, she was one of his top advisors on his top advisory committee. So, you know, we're not suddenly going to see, oh, we're veering to the right now or veering to the left or whatever. She's going to keep on the same path. And plus, she doesn't have a lot of time.
Indeed, as you mentioned before, but certainly this whole controversy involving, you know, police community relations, that's something that Eric Holder has been dealing with. And it seems like that will be an ongoing issue for Loretta Lynch to deal with. And any sense of sort of where she, if there is a side in this or where she comes down on this issue? So complicated.
Oh, no. I imagine she's probably a lot like it. She probably thinks the same way Eric Holder does, but she has a lot of support from the law enforcement community.
I noticed that.
Ray Kelly came out in favor of her. Police chiefs have come out in favor of her. So, you know, I think that she, she understands what it's like to be a cop in some of these tough neighborhoods. And she also understands that, you know, things have to change for there to be trust and community building. And I think she also, you know, as someone whose dad was a pastor, I wrote a story about all this. I read every speech she ever gave that I was able to get, you know, maybe 600 pages of them. And you get a real sense that she understands the history of, like, the Civil Rights Act, what it means to be black in America, what it means to, you know, her family, you know, during the Civil Rights Movement. I believe her father hid, people being chased by, you know, brutal white sheriffs, you know, their neighbors and friends hid them in their basement or in the church. I forget which one. So I think she has a real sense of that, too. I think she's kind of in a unique spot to address some of that. I'm really interested to see how she does it.
Yeah.
We don't know. She's been mum about it. And anyone who says they know doesn't understand, as one guy told me in my story today, your legacy as attorney general often is not defined by, what policies you enact. It's what confronts you. So Elliot Richardson, Richard Nixon, right? He was a total toady. I mean, the Nixon tapes reveal that he was very much a Nixon man. But that one moment where he stood up to Nixon and the Saturday night massacre happened and Archibald Cox gets fired, Ruckelhaus quits, the deputy attorney general Richardson quits, you know, everyone realizes what Nixon's really about. And you have this moment, and now Richardson's a hero, and his even Holder had his portrait up on the wall in his office. And what if Richardson doesn't get that chance? You know, he's not a hero. He goes down in history, you know, as, you know, John Mitchell 2.0, you know. So we don't know it. I didn't mean to digress there.
No. That's a fascinating digression, and it takes me back to my youth. A comment from Thaddeus from Northeast Philadelphia. He says, I think the delay in Lynch's confirmation by the Republicans was strictly based on racism and sexism. Gee, I know you don't want to get too deep into some of the psychology here, but do you think there's some truth to that, Del?
You know, I don't want to really weigh into that. I think that it's very complicated.
Yeah.
And I think it cuts across so many different things. I'm not, one side says one thing, another side says another thing. I think that, it's just really, it's like dealing with this police, and it's like dealing with the police and community issue. Like, we all recognize that police have a tough job, right? They have a very tough job. Yep. We all recognize that communities, have not been always fairly policed. And how do you, for over a long history, and that's why some of them are so mad. And so, or many in these communities can be mad and upset and frustrated. And I just don't, but where did it start? I don't know. It's a chicken egg question.
I hear you. Let me ask you about a couple of other things that Loretta Lynch did say at her confirmation hearing. She does support the death penalty, as I understand it. Yes?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And she also called the NSA data collection, which, not everybody's pleased with this, as constitutional and effective. Those were her words. What does that tell you, or what does that tell us?
I think that, she's been doing this a long time. I think she's a longtime federal prosecutor. So remember, there's been a bunch of easing of sentencing reform and charging policies that the Justice Department dealing with crack cocaine, marijuana, drugs, right?
Right.
And a lot of the line prosecutors, reports have shown this, were not pleased by it because they've worked really hard to enforce these laws and do things like this, and they believe that the crack dealers are really bad guys. And so, they weren't always pleased by this, but they went along because the boss said to do it. And I think that she is in line with a lot of the line prosecutors too. I think that she probably does not have a lot of patience for criminals. And I think that she probably does believe, because she's, she did grow up in North Carolina, the South, where, there's a slightly more, I think, tough on crime kind of general ethos, and that she probably is pro-death penalty. I don't know if she's pro-death penalty. Mm-hmm. I think she's not against it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Like, I don't think she's out there with a death penalty march holding, Sparky. Let's hook up old Sparky again, I think that she's more like not against it. And I think in terms of, she has to, as a national security figure in any of these things, really has to kind of be like for the data collection and stuff like that. That's her role, to advocate for the government. And President Obama says, hey, he's trying to find new ways to do it. And they're all working to try to find a new way to do this thing. The law expires, I believe, in June, Section 215. I'm not surprised by that.
Well, we could go on, but we have to say goodbye to you. Del Quinton Wilbur, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Yeah, thank you. And again, Bloomberg News.
I was just going to say that. Reporter for Bloomberg News.
You had said the Washington Post or New York Times or something, but they're my rival.
I got you. And I apologize for that.
That's okay.
Reporter for Bloomberg News, covering the Justice Department and Homeland Security, and also wrote a book called Rawhide Down. I should proofread what I write sometimes. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to sign up for our newsletter, how to find us on Facebook, and how to follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.